few years ago, I visited my alma mater, Grove City College, which is in Northwest Pennsylvania. I went up to see what the campus had looked like since I graduated back in 1996. The old cinder block classrooms had been replaced by a brand new state-of-the-art facility, complete with amphitheater-style lecture halls, fully equipped with the latest technology. The dated student union had been replaced with a brand new multi-level student center, equipped with various areas for eating and studying and meeting. There were food vendors that served every kind of food you could imagine, a far cry from the fries and grilled cheese sandwiches we ate back in the day. And the whole campus had been beautified with landscaping and decorative fountains, and it was truly a sight to behold. Many colleges and universities have homecoming celebrations every year, a time to return to the special place where we had many formative experiences, see old friends and professors, visit the old student union, or stand in our old dorm rooms, take in the memories. Homecomings are special times of remembrance. They're deep inside the human heart, I think, is the desire to return home, to return to what is familiar. Familiar settings, familiar people, places of comfort and security, with good memories. The Israelites experienced a similar homecoming, a return to their homeland after a time of exile. This is part of our series on the story, the Bible as one continuous story of God and God's people. We looked at the fall of the kingdoms of Israel, first the north, then the south, and we saw God's people taken into exile because of their disobedience to God's covenant. But God didn't abandon his people in their time of exile. He worked in and through their lives and the lives of the governments that were over them. God promised a return to their homeland. And in today's passage, we see the fulfillment of that promise. God returns the people home. Now, how does God bring this about? And what does this say about God and God's view of the people? And how is this story, this lower story, part of God's bigger upper story, his grand plan of redemption for all of humanity? And how do we fit into that? What does this story mean for our story? We'll look at these things today. We are entering a part of the Old Testament that may be more unfamiliar to folks. We're in the book of Ezra. Ezra was a priest of Israel, and he recounts the story of how God brought his people back to their homeland. From the passage we read today, King Cyrus of Persia had overtaken Babylon, and he ruled over the land. And it says in the text he was moved by God's Spirit to allow God's people to return to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple that had been leveled before. All the families of Judah and Benjamin, priests and Levites, were to prepare themselves, and as the Spirit moved, they were to go back. They were also given gifts from their Persian neighbors, gold and silver and animals and other costly gifts. Nice going away party. And the king himself also gave them articles from the temple that had been taken by Nebuchadnezzar. Silver and gold basins and bowls and knives and other vessels. Everything they would need to begin worshiping at the temple again. And so God's people returned to Jerusalem. It was joyful, yet bittersweet. Remember, when they had left Jerusalem for Babylon, they left after being laid siege by the Babylonian army. The city had been leveled and burned to the ground. The riches of the temple had been plundered. They were leaving as slaves, defeated and demoralized, and only the poorest of the poor had been left behind to fend for themselves. Their return some 70 years later was joyful, better than being in exile, but they didn't come back to much. It was sort of like my Grove City College experience, but in reverse. Instead of seeing all the new and improved version of what they had left, their beloved city was now in ruins. Imagine the scene. Jerusalem is in ruins, the buildings were leveled, there was no infrastructure, no business, no commerce, no stores, no markets, no homes. Not a particularly livable place. Most importantly, there was no temple with which to worship the Lord. That was key to their worship. must have been heartbreaking to see their hometown in such devastation. However, the people began rebuilding. They began to make burnt offerings again to the Lord. They started a capital campaign to replace the temple's foundation. They began to work up to fix their former place of worship. And their efforts were not without opposition. We read in the story that there were some outside agitators a couple of occasions that pushed back and tried to discourage them and keep them from doing the work God had called them to do. And that's to be expected when undergoing God's work. There's always that opposition and resistance. And they needed some nudging from some of the prophets to call them back. They would start to get a little complacent and focus more on their own homes and businesses, their own lives, and the prophets had to sort of push them back to their focus to get the temple done. And they eventually did. They eventually got together and rebuilt the temple. When they finished the foundation, they celebrated. The priests donned their vestments, blew trumpets, clashed cymbals, and sang songs of praise to the Lord. For he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever toward Israel. The people responded with a great shout, praising the Lord because the foundation had been laid. However, there were mixed emotions on that day. It was a joy to be back in Jerusalem, their homeland. It was a joy to have the temple foundation rebuilt. It was a joy to have hope and a future again. But there was also the grief over what had been lost. Some could remember the temple in all its former glory. Remember, we read about it when Solomon had undertaken to build the temple, and it was resplendent with all kinds of gold and valuables and was just such a spectacular sight to behold. And now here we see a roughly built foundation of this once glorious structure, and those who could remember it back then probably found it difficult now to see it, remembering what it was to seeing what it was now. It was better than nothing, but it was far from the glory of what they recall. The text tells us there were both shouts of joy as well as wails of grief that day. And the noise was such that it was tough to distinguish between the shouts of joy and the wails of lament. There was kind of this bittersweet reaction. They were joyful to be home, but their home wasn't quite the way it was when they left it, and may never quite be the way they remembered it. So when we read this account of the exile's return and God's overall story of redemption and this bittersweet homecoming, what do we learn from it? What does it have to say to us today? Well, I think one of the things it shows us is that God did not abandon his people. Sure, he punished them for their sin, but did not reject them forever. God redeemed them and brought them home. God showed us God was ultimately in control of events. His spirit worked in the heart of King Cyrus and in Cyrus's officials, and a foreign leader to bring people to freedom and restoration. God worked through the circumstances. This further shows us that God does not break God's promises, that God remains faithful even when we are not faithful to him. God remained faithful to his covenant even when his people were constantly unfaithful. Even amidst the people's sin and disobedience and idolatry, these could not render God's covenant null and void. God did not abandon Judah, and God will not abandon us either. This story gives us hope for the future, just as it gave hope to Judah. We are promised an even greater future with God's kingdom, the new heavens and the new earth, where Christ will reign. The worship of God would not happen in a building, in a temple, or a physical locality, but wherever God's people are in spirit and in truth. In fact, this Messiah would come not just for God's people, Israel, but for all people. God's ultimate purpose was to restore all of creation, to bring all of creation back to its original glory. Now, like the exiles returning to Jerusalem with their bittersweet homecoming, sometimes we may look at our church in the modern age and also feel a similar bittersweet reaction. We might get discouraged. We might look at our church and remember the glory days, back when the pews were full and Sunday school classrooms were brimming with children and collection plates overflowed with donations, and we had more people, especially younger people, more programming, more energy, more money. Moreover, the culture around us was more hospitable. Stores were closed on Sundays, and kids didn't have sporting events taking them away from church. We were the only game in town, so to speak. We didn't have to compete with the world around us. People went to church because it was the thing to do. In today's world, however, we see this is not the case. Christianity is losing its position of privilege in society. It's being pushed further to the margins, and we're not quite sure how to respond. Like the exiles, we joyfully gather to worship God, but for some of us, this joy may be bittersweet when we remember the things were compared to how they are now. The metaphor of exile is one I've seen used from time to time in describing this marginalization of the church in our modern culture. Instead of the church being sent to Babylon, Babylon's come to us in some sense. One missiologist describes it this way: Christians are no longer at the center of society, but instead they are on the margins. Gone are the days when Christians and the church could expect to be in a privileged position in the eyes of secular institutions and be given rights or inroads into broader society. In the same way that Israel was sent into exile by God, we have been sent into exile by our culture as it finds the church unnecessary and irrelevant to its day-to-day existence. That sounds kind of depressing. Like the exiles returning home, we have to learn to adapt to a world that is very different from the ones we might have left back in previous times, that we might recall from our childhood. Like the Israelites, we can feel bittersweet, glad to be at home, but also remembering the glory days back then. But exile doesn't have to be all bad or all depressing. There can be a source of hope and opportunity in exile rather than disappointment and despair. The same missiologist says, personally, instead of finding the image a negative one, he's saying of the image of the exile, I have found it a source of comfort. It is in exile that God purifies us, that God draws near to us and draws us near to him if we let him, and speaks to us about the hope of good things that are to come. God uses exile as a time of refining and refocusing. We see it here. He refined and refocused Judah's loyalty and priorities. God used Judah to make a positive difference in the culture of Babylon and Persia. In Jeremiah 29, the prophet gives a word of the Lord to the people regarding how they were to live in exile in their new home in Babylon. Basically, they were to get married and build houses and plant gardens for food to eat. In other words, put down roots. Become a productive member of society. You're not going anywhere anytime soon, so settle in and make the best of it. They were also told to seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. Jeremiah 29, verse 7. In other words, seek the good of the neighborhoods you're living in. Don't declare a culture war and take over by force, but instead pray to the Lord on its behalf. Its welfare is tied to your welfare, so do your best to be good neighbors to those around you. By all means, retain your customs and beliefs, but settle in and make yourself at home and be a good neighbor to those around you. Pray for them. Pray for their well-being. This is not just good for you, it's good for all those around you. During the time the Judahites were living in Babylon, getting to know their neighbors, having their kids play together, working together for the good of their community, they began to have a positive influence over those around them. I'm sure the average Babylonian was probably not thrilled about living under a despotic leader like Nebuchadnezzar any more than anyone else was. I'm sure they got tired of sacrificing their children to random capricious gods to ward off famine or war or whatever. I'm sure they were hungry for a relationship with a different kind of God, one who valued human life and forbid human sacrifice, who viewed all people as equal and commanded fair treatment of all, who was compassionate and merciful and cared for his people even when they were in exile. I can imagine that as the Babylonians observed their Judahite neighbors and practice their faith, some of them were inspired to say, so tell me about this Yahweh you serve. While some of the Judahites were taken into exile did return to their homeland, there were many who stayed in Babylon and retained their Jewish religion and culture while positively influencing the culture around them. I think this can be a model for us here and now, in our culture, as we feel like we're perhaps in a form of exile, or at very least, a decline of the cultural privilege we took for granted for so long. We too can seek the welfare of our city, pray for neighbors and do good to them. We can live out, with the Spirit's help, our faith in Jesus, and model a better way to live than that of the broader culture. We can make people want to ask us, "So tell me about this Jesus you serve." Evangelism often gets a bad rap. We're uncomfortable with it because we think we have to give some high-pressure sales pitch. Evangelism conjures up street images, street preachers shouting at a megaphone at passers-by, warning of hellfire and damnation. This kind of evangelism strikes us as coercive and manipulative. But evangelism doesn't have to be this way. The word itself comes from the Greek word meaning good news. Evangelism simply means living out the good news of Jesus, showing Jesus' love to our neighbors, and being open to sharing our experiences with them when they ask. It doesn't need to be a high-pressure sales pitch, and we can leave the results to the Holy Spirit. We just do our best to live out our faith while being open to talking about it and listening to others' experiences when the opportunity arises. I always have interesting encounters when I wear my clergy collar out and about. One day I was walking around some shops in a nearby town, and one man saw my collar and proceeded to tell me the story of how he found Jesus after serving in the Iraq War. He shared with me that at a particularly low point in his life, the army chaplain told him to start taking photographs of things that were bigger than himself. And that opened him up to God. And that led him to Jesus. And he became a photographer and artist and now creates art to bless other people and shares his story with other people. On other occasions, I've worn my collar at different places on Main Street, like Starbucks and Brouhaha. And it's not unusual for the college students working there to ask about my job or my church in a positive way. They're curious. They want to know more about it. I hear lots of talk about people just not being interested in religion anymore. But if any of these encounters are any indication, I think people are hungry for spiritual interaction, and they're looking for a safe place to go or a safe person to talk to about these things. Maybe they've been burned out on institutional religion or just have a lot of questions and doubts that they're afraid to say out loud. But I think if we're willing to be open, we can be a safe person. We can create a safe space for these conversations to happen. Now, I don't think I'm special. I just think I happen to be wearing something that signals to others that they can talk to me about spiritual things. But we don't need to wear clergy collars or I Heart Jesus buttons to be a safe person with whom other people can discuss matters of spiritual importance, matters of faith. By building relationships with others, listening to them, treating them with respect, showing them kindness and concern, we can be the safe people to whom others turn to ask about spiritual things. And our community, this local church, can be a safe place where people can explore what it means to be in a relationship with Jesus, what that looks like in our real world. And we can share our doubts and struggles as well. And through these relationships, we can have a positive impact. Of course, this means we have to take our own faith seriously. We need to be actively growing in our own relationship with Jesus so we can have something to share when the time comes. And if we do this, I think we'll find that God can use us, just as he used the Judahites to influence the Babylonians and the Persians. The exiles returned to a Jerusalem that was far from the glorious city they remembered from the youth. Their homecoming was bittersweet, but God was with them and led them. We might feel at times like we're returning from exile to a world that looks very different from the one that we might have grown up in. Yet as we seek the good of our neighbors and pray for them and live out our faith in their midst, I think we'll find that just as the Judahites found, that God is in our midst and working in and through us, and the Spirit is active and at work. And others will see how we're living and eventually work up the nerve to say, "So tell me about this Jesus you serve." So may God make us evangelists in the best sense of the word, who can influence our world and our neighborhoods and our communities for good. And may God bless this message to our hearing. Amen.